The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com. Metaxas Show with your host, Eric Metaxas.
Hey there, folks. As you know, we like to help our audience understand things. What is bigger right now than the horror of socialism? We keep hearing about socialism. In my whole lifetime, you hardly ever heard about it. It's basically the cousin to communism. It's bad news. But somehow people, I guess because they're young and rather ignorant of what it is, have been tempted to look into it, to be open to it. That's not good. And so I thought, why don't we have on our friend Bill Federer or William Federer to talk about it. Bill, welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you, Eric.
Now, you've written a book called Socialism, The Real History from Plato to the Present. People need to know how to find you. You are a treasure trove of resources. I hope people will go to AmericanMinute.com. You know, when I meet somebody like you, Bill, I just get excited because I think here's somebody I can just send people to Bill. There's just a raft of stuff that they can find at AmericanMinute.com. We need to prepare ourselves and to understand many things. So one of the things that you talk about, of course, in this, one of the things about which you've written an entire book is socialism, which you just showed us. So let's start from the beginning. When you say socialism, the real history from Plato to the present, I never would have thought of going back to Plato unless we're talking about some kind of utopianist society. Why do you start giving us the history of socialism? Why do you start with Plato?
Well, Plato lived 380 BC in Athens, and he writes in passing of Atlantis, this highly structured civilization on an island that sinks in the sea. Now, whether or not it existed, who knows? It could be Santorini, which used to be a volcanic island in the Mediterranean. But nevertheless, Plato considered Atlantis the ideal structured society, and he considered democracy an unstructured society. Democracy, demos means people, krasi means rule, and the chief characteristic of a democracy is tolerance. Everybody tolerates each other. It's wonderful. It's like a bazaar where you can buy any viewpoint, like an embroidery patchwork on a cloth. But then they begin to tolerate people that are a little bit off, and then they tolerate people that are a lot off. To finally tolerate crooks and crime and fraud.
But wait. So you're talking about Plato's idea when he writes about democracy. He's telling us about the downside of democracy. And by the way, there's truth in it, right? In other words, if you set up a government with freedom, there's a downside to freedom, because what happens if people start freely choosing bad stuff? So Plato, I guess, is representing that idea.
Right. And so he said that democracy is based on the people having virtue, and the people really don't have virtue. If you give them a choice of giving up their life or giving up their virtue, they'll always give up their virtue to save their life. Now, in ancient Israel's model, it lasted a little longer because they had a big magnet in the sky called God, that you were virtuous because you were accountable to him. But Athens didn't have that.
Wait. You've got so much wonderful information. You're like a fire hose. I just want to make sure everybody's tracking, because this is so important what you just said. You said that ancient Israel had a type of democracy. Most people are not really aware of that. Most people, whenever we talk about democracy, we talk about the Greeks. Tell us, when you say Israel had some kind of democracy, what do you mean?
Well, the word democracy, republic, they're sort of interchangeable with what's called a popular government. Popular meaning populace or the people. And so when the whole world was ruled by kings, pharaohs, Caesars, when Israel comes out of Egypt around 1400 BC, for 400 years, they do not have a king. This is a total anomaly in world history. And it worked, their system. It's called the Hebrew Republic. It worked because every citizen was taught the law. and they were individually accountable to God to follow the law. And it worked until the priests stopped teaching the law. And the high priest Eli, his own sons were sleeping with women in the very tent where the Ark of the Covenant was. Another priest had a graven image in the house of a guy named Micah. Another Levite had a concubine. And so the priests stopped teaching the law. They all go to Samuel the prophet, and they say, this is not working. We want to be like the other countries. We want a king. And the rubber band snaps back.
Okay, so written about the Hebrew Republic in another book?
Right. Primarily in a book called Who is the King in America? And then another one called Rise of the Tyrant. And it goes through democracies and republics, how they rose, how they fell.
Who is the King in America and Rise of the Tyrant? I say this, Bill, just because I want people to know they can find these resources. I guess at AmericanMinute.com, is that the place?
Right. And but matching the Israel model with Plato's. So Plato says that a democracy is doomed to fail because if people really don't have virtue, and he said they tolerate people, they tolerate each other. It's great. Then they tolerate people that are off. Then they tolerate people that are a lot off till finally they're tolerating lawlessness and chaos. And then the people begin to say, can't someone come along and fix this mess? And that's when some governor comes along and he says, I can fix it. I just need some emergency powers. And they begin to consolidate power and fix it. But finally, they stand up in the chariot of state holding the reins of power, and they're revealed as the tyrant. And this tyrant begins to institute a structured society. And so he is the philosopher king, the head of gold. His administrators and military are the arms and chest of silver. They're the They make up the deep state ruling class, and everyone else is the abdomen of iron and bronze, and they are the ruled class.
Now, wait, where do you get, is that what Plato talks about? He talks about this abdomen of iron and bronze, and these are his terms.
Right. So Plato says that the philosopher king is the head of gold, and his administrative class are the arms and chest of silver. And they're more valuable, so they get treated a little extra special. Everyone else is the abdomen of iron and bronze. They are the working class, the commoners. And the commoners own no property. Everything's owned in common. They have no privacy. The ruling class decides who gets to have kids and takes the kids away from the families and indoctrinates them with noble lies. Actually calls him that.
Let me ask you a question, because I've not heard you talk about this before. This is really important and beautiful that you're breaking this down. What you're talking about, of course, is effectively happening now. In other words, as you slide away from real democracy, having a republic where the people have a voice, and the cultural elites become the rulers, what you're saying, this is why I said I want to ask you this. You said before, the reason that Plato says a democracy won't work is because the people are not virtuous. Now, you know, and I know that the founders understood this. That's why they instituted, you know, this basic idea, the golden triangle of freedom. It's like, we need to have virtuous people. We need to have people of faith. In Israel, of course, it worked because the people were directly responsible to God. But what you're talking about right now, if somebody says, all right, the people aren't virtuous, so we're going to have a philosopher king, why would Plato assume that the philosopher king himself would be virtuous, or that the silver ruling class would be virtuous? How are they any different from the people below?
Right. So Aristotle, a student of Plato, said when the virtue of the people is lacking, then it's outweighed by the virtue of the philosopher king dictator. It's just an excuse for Alexander the Great to seize power. That's all it is. And
so it's kind of what's happening in America today. That's why I want to say that, in other words, that as we've drifted away from God and as we've ceased to understand how to govern ourselves, naturally we drift in this direction where more and more power goes to the few at the top. At least that's what it sounds like.
Right. So whenever you have a administrative class that is redistributing and dispensing stuff, that's called having power. And people that are in power sort of don't want to give it up. And so the temptation is for them to redistribute to those that will help them stay in power and take away those from those who threaten their power. So it turns into a pyramid structured of society.
And this is called corruption. Folks, I'm talking to our dear friend. I got to say, Bill, it's a joy to speak with you. I want people to go to AmericanMinute.com. AmericanMinute.com. The book we're talking about is Socialism, the Real History from Plato to the Present. We'll be back with more of Bill Federer. Don't go away.
You see the life that you've left behind. When you think it over, do you ever...
Folks, I'm talking to William Federer, author of many, many books and a dear friend of this program. Bill, the book we're talking about now is called Socialism, the Real History from Plato to the Present. You've written many books. I want people to go to AmericanMinute.com. So you're giving us this history, and I love it. Tell us more. In other words, you just described Plato and how he explains what happens when you drift from democracy to, it's really an oligarchy, philosopher king, top-down rule. So you're effectively saying that is what socialism is.
Right. So it's a structured society. Now, if we skip forward 2,000 years from 380 BC to around 1516 AD, you have Sir Thomas More, and he writes a book called Island of Utopia, and he's modeling it after Plato's Atlantis. And so this is only 20 years after Columbus discovers America. It's a fictitious island off the coast of South America. The word utopia means nowhere. And it's written as a Greek dialogue with a traveler who's named Hythlodeus, which means peddler of nonsense. So here we have the island of utopia told by the peddler of nonsense. And it is a structured society with a ruling class and a commoner class. And the commoners own no property. They have no privacy. It's free healthcare, free identical clothing, free food in communal monastic style dining halls. Everyone wears the identical clothes. Everyone lives in three-story houses that are identical with no locks on any doors. There's no privacy. There's no ale houses or coffee houses. The government tracks everyone everywhere you go, and the government decides who gets to have children, and then takes the children away from the family and indoctrinates them with noble lies. And so this is utopia. This is this perfectly structured society.
And then not perfectly structured for the people in the lower classes, obviously.
Obvious. Yes, definitely. And so a century later, you have Sir Francis Bacon, and he writes The New Atlantis. So he's directly calling it New Atlantis, referring to Plato's Atlantis. And this New Atlantis is an island in the Pacific. Again, structured with the ruling class and commoners, a little more scientific careers because of the scientific revolution. Someone wrote a satire on it. Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels.
Now, wait a Gulliver. Second. Francis, did you say Francis Bacon?
Yeah, yeah.
I always get Francis Bacon confused with Roger Bacon. Roger Bacon is about 200 years before that, I guess, right? Francis Bacon writes a book, and what is it called again?
It's called The New Atlantis.
Okay, because I'm not familiar with that, but you're telling me that Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels is a takeoff on that.
Right, it's a satire. So here's a guy washed up on an island, and it's highly structured. And there's the ruling class that rules with this minutiae ridiculousness, and then the commoners that just have to do their job all their life. And why is this important? The pilgrims. So the pilgrims were originally a company colony with bylaws written by investors that look back to Plato, Sir Thomas More, Sir Francis Bacon. Right. And the pilgrim bylaws say this: all goods gotten by trucking, trafficking, trading, fishing shall go into ye common stock, and everyone's livelihood shall come out of ye common stock. And so they were attempting to do this communism type of thing. And William Bradford, the governor of the Pilgrims, says it failed. He says, this proves the emptiness of the theory of Plato applauded recently by scholars in Europe. Here's the governor of the Pilgrims knowing that they were attempting to live out Plato. He says the emptiness of the theory of Plato. He says that the taking away of private property and owning in a community would somehow make men happy as if they were wiser than God. He says the young man objected to doing twice as much work as the old guy, but got paid the same. The old guy considered it a dishonor to be classed in labor with the young guy. And he says the women objected to having to wash other men's clothes.
Now, Bill, just to be clear, this really happened. We rarely hear about this, but the Pilgrims originally, this is the Massachusetts Bay Colony or in Plymouth?
This was their Massachusetts Bay, Plymouth Colony.
Well, but so you're saying that they really tried this and Bradford realized it's not working. How long did they try it for before they realized we've got to do something else?
Well, William Bradford said over 2 years, and he said that they nearly starved to death. And so he said we had to come up with a way to so we wouldn't have to suffer want like another winter of starvation. So after much discussion, it was decided that every man should plant corn for his own household. Wow, what a novel idea.
Isn't it funny? Like it's so basic, and yet they really experienced this. This is not some theory. They lived out a socialist type government society, and they said, this isn't working. What if we let everyone take some care of himself, and suddenly you get a type of capitalism?
Yeah. And so he said, every family was assigned a parcel of land. This made all hands more industrious. The women now went willingly into the field and took their little ones with them to plant corn, while before they would allege weakness, and to have forced them would have been considered great oppression. Right.
Isn't this amazing?
So the Pilgrims switched from a communistic socialist form of government to what's called a covenant form of government, where you're taking care of your neighbor, not because the bylaws say so, but because you're doing it as unto God.
It's just, as I say, to me, it's almost funny because they try it, they see it doesn't work, and then they change it. Most people, when they're talking about the history of socialism, they wouldn't necessarily go back to Plato or even to the Pilgrims. And you know, most of us, even if we learned it, we forgot that the Pilgrims tried this for 2 years. Why did the Pilgrims try this? It's kind of a funny thing that they thought, we're going to invent a new way of community. And they really thought this might be it.
Right. Well, the investors are the ones that came up with the model.
Uh-huh.
And they were looking back to Plato and Sir Thomas More, Sir Francis Bacon. People say, well, isn't the church socialist? Didn't the early church own everything in common? Two big differences, voluntary versus involuntary, and church versus government. So the early believers voluntarily sold their land and laid the money at the feet of who? The apostles, for the church to distribute. They weren't forced to sell their land and put it at the feet of Pilate for the Roman government to distribute. Here, Pilate, here's a little more money for you. No. And so we see the Bible is filled full of people owning private property. They go into the promised land. God divides up the property amongst the 12 tribes and all the families. Now, if you own property, you can accumulate stuff. That's called being blessed. Karl Marx called it being a capitalist. Right. So Marx said communism can be summed up in one sentence: abolition of private property. And Lenin said socialism is a transition phase to communism. And then if you own stuff, you can be moved upon in your heart to give some of it away. That is called charity. Right. So it's voluntary.
When it's voluntary, as you say, it's completely different, because if you look at human nature, it really is entirely different. If a communist government forces me to do anything, I will naturally feel oppressed. I might even do the same thing. If I do it freely, I won't feel oppressed. So that's kind of at the heart of this.
Right. If you think of it, I mean, here's God. He made everything. He exists for eternity, and everything obeys him. And it follows laws of planetary motion, laws of gravity, laws of physics, laws of science. And it's almost like he said, you know, been there, done that. I can make things that obey me. At some time in eternity past, God said, you know, I would really like someone in my image that could love me. And so he creates this thing we call reality, and he hides himself behind creation, because if he ever revealed himself, he's so totally awesome, every molecule in our being would fall flat in front of him, and he wouldn't know if we loved him because he's so totally awesome or because it's a voluntary, free will, loving choice. I use the example of a billionaire has a son that goes to college and he drives up with his Lamborghini, his fancy clothes. He's going to have every girl wanting to be friends, right? But if he leaves that aside and drives up in an old clunker with holes in his jeans, all the uppity girls are going to ignore him. But then he meets a girl. They like to study in the library. They have an ice cream cone together and they fall in love and they get engaged. And then he says, I want to take you back to meet my dad. And they're driving up to this mansion and the girl says, whoa, you didn't tell me about this. He knows the girl loves him for him, not because of all the stuff. Right. And so Here's God. He creates this thing and he gives us this ability. And all private property is something with which we can express what's in our heart.
It's extraordinary. I want to tell people again, please go to AmericanMinute.com. Bill, you've written so many books. They're a treasure. I hope particularly people who are involved in homeschooling are familiar with your work. I say the same thing about John Zmirak. People need to use these great resources. One of them is named John Zmirak. Another is named William Federer. Go to AmericanMinute.com. And folks, don't forget, when you go to MyPillow.com or MyStore.com, please use the code ERIC. We would appreciate it. We'll be right back with William Federer.
I've been walking these streets so long, singing the same old song. I know every crack in these dirty sidewalks of Broadway.
Folks, I'm talking to Bill Federer, or William Federer, and his website is AmericanMinute.com. Tons of great stuff there. Bill, so you're taking us through the history of socialism. The book is Socialism, the Real History from Plato to the Present. So let's keep going. You say that William Bradford and the Pilgrims tried socialism, or they tried this kind of communistic way. It didn't work. It led to people being disgruntled and selfish and all this kind of stuff. So where do we go from that? That's the 1620s.
Right. So the Pilgrims had a covenant form of government. And what's that? It's where people are in agreement with each other. But more than an agreement, it's a commitment to caring for each other. Why? Not because the bylaws say so, but because you're accountable to God. Jesus says, whatever you do to the least of these, my brethren, you've done it to me. And you get your rights from God. So it's sort of like a triangle, rights from God, care for your neighbor, you're accountable to God. In the next century, after the Pilgrims, covenant turned into social contract. And it was just people in agreement with each other. And if God was there, he was distant. This comes out of the scientific revolution, where they discovered laws of planetary motion, laws of physics, laws of science, laws of optics. And some theologians said, well, maybe God made everything with laws. And then like a guy winds up a clock and sets it on a shelf, everything's following these gears. And if God is there, he's impersonal, he's distant, he's not involved. So we go from covenant to social contract with a distant God. And the next century, you have the French Revolution, and it's social contract with no God. And the next century after that is socialism and Marxism, where the state is God. You get your rights from the state. You're accountable to the state. And so
you can't escape reality, right? I mean, it's fascinating to me that one way or the other, you have to deal with these things. And if you decide to push God away, some unpleasant things are going to come in. In other words, if you don't do what we do today, which is ostensibly self-government, where we have liberty and we have responsibilities, if you don't do that, somebody comes in and will rule you. And so even though in places like France and the French Revolution, it sounds beautiful, but it's not beautiful. They have these beautiful ideals, but if you push God out, in a sense, it can't work.
There's a thought. What if older fish could teach younger fish to stay away from shiny things dangling in the water, like a fishing lure? Well, they can't. And so every new generation of younger fish is attracted to it. Socialism is a shiny thing dangling in the water. Free food, free healthcare, free education, free clothes, free everything. Free is attractive, but there's a hook there. And so socialism is the eternal bait and switch. And there's a quote from Calvin Coolidge. He says, just because something needs to be done does not mean it's the government's job to do it. And then another quote from Gerald Ford, where he said, the government that's big enough to give us everything we want is big enough to take away everything we have. So if you want a government to provide and give you all that free stuff, it will in exchange. Sort of like in Egypt, you need food. And the government says, we'll give you a bag of grain, but it's in exchange for your land, your cattle, your children, and your lives. So whenever the government redistributes anything, it does it in exchange for your freedoms. When the church helps people, the church wants that person to become successful so they can help the next needy person that comes along. And this thing called the body of Christ can grow, right? Now, in one of the chapters in my book, I go through, God gives commands to five groups: individuals, families, business, church, and government. There are commands for individuals to take care of the poor. There is relatively few. Family commands are mostly husbands, love your wives, children, submit to your parents. There is, you know, take care of your relative or you're worse than an infidel. Business is do an honest day's work. Don't hold back wages. There is leave the gleanings of your field for poor people to pick through. The church definitely has commands to take care of the poor. And historically, they've started orphanages, medical clinics, and dug wells in villages. There's no command for the government to take care of the poor. The command to the government is the shortest: protect the innocent, punish the guilty. There's no command for the government to be involved in health care, welfare.
So that's the problem, though, right? In other words, that the government has grown and has taken on all of these other roles that they basically say, we will tax you and we will take care of the poor, rather than allowing the private sector to do those things. And that's really been the story of the last 100 years, hasn't it?
Yeah, you're hitting it on the head. It took the Second Great Awakening revival, and it was, you know, the Charles Finney, you know, every member must work. And so it started William Booth, the Salvation Army, and George Williams start the YMCA, and it's, hey, let's do things. Well, what happened is, it turned into, let's do things without the gospel. And it turned into this social gospel. And then it just got rid of God. And then it's an excuse for the government to usurp power. But the interesting thing is that when the church helps people, the person experiences the love of God in a personal way. And the giver gets to experience the joy of God using them to meet someone's need. When the government helps people, it's impersonal. And the recipient is not only not grateful, they begin to view it as a debt owed to them. And then after receiving free stuff after a while, it lowers their self-esteem and they want to channel that negative feeling somewhere. They end up hating the very government that's giving them the free stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of sick, actually. I want to remind people that they can find more at AmericanMinute.com. Folks, there's all kinds of stuff there. AmericanMinute.com. We reference the book Socialism, the Real History from Plato to the Present, and other books by William Federer. We'll be right back.
When you get the blues, get a rock and roll feeling in your bones, put taps on your toes, get gone, get a rhythm.
Hey there, folks. We're getting the history of socialism, from Plato to the present. Bill Federer is our tour guide. Bill, where are we in this history?
Well, the second half of the book, I pick up with the French Revolution. And so we had a revolution. France helped us. You know what they got in return for helping us? Nothing but debt, lots of it. And then their crops failed. And the people thought, if we can just chop off King Louis XVI and Queen Marie Antoinette's heads, our problems will be solved. Well, they chop it off. It doesn't get any better. Then they chop off the heads of the royalty. Doesn't get any better. Then they chop off the heads of the wealthy. You got money. We don't. You're selfish. It doesn't get any better. Then they chop off the heads of the businessmen and farmers. You have food and supplies. We don't. You're selfish. Then they chop off the heads of the hoarders, the people that have extra food. You got extra. I don't have enough. You're selfish. Then they chop off the heads of the clergy because they're speaking out against the head chopping off stuff. And then they chop off the heads of the former revolutionaries, the ones who used to chop off heads but got tired of it. 30,000 people had their heads chopped off in Paris, France.
Now, hang on. This is just huge. This is huge because I'm familiar with this. But as you put it, out there, it's hard for us to believe that this is true. In Paris, 30,000 people went to the guillotine. And it seems to me, I guess the question would be, why do they feel that they had to chop off their heads? What's the idea here? How is this helping that everybody's being executed in this bloodbath?
So the motto of the French Revolution was liberty, equality, fraternity. Fraternity was their word for socialism. It's the fraternity, the group, the collective, the mob. And equality can be understood two ways. In America, it was equal treatment before the law. In France, it was everyone having an equal amount of stuff. And if the fraternité, the mob, the group, the state thinks you have too much stuff, it can take away your stuff and redistribute it and kill you, right? And so they did this bloodbath in Paris. They even tore down statues, the statue of good King Henry IV, and they dug up the bones of St. Genevieve and trashed them. They wanted to get rid of history. Matter of fact, that's one of the chapters in the book. It's a concept called deconstruction, where you destroy the history of the past so people don't have a memory of where they came from, and then you brainwash them into the future you have planned for them.
And of course, this is sounding eerily familiar, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like a gene replacement therapy for a culture. I even go back to China, third century BC. There was a leader, Qin Shi Huangdi, and he consolidated a bunch of kingdoms and did things differently than they had been done before. So he decided to destroy all records of how things were done before. This was a model that Mao Zedong copied in the 1960s with his Cultural Revolution. He destroyed thousands of years. Fundamentalist Muslims come into a country, they destroy the history. And so this is sort of a sales technique.
Okay, so what is happening right now when we see people tearing down statues and redefining everything, saying that something you said 20 years ago is now racist? It's a very similar thing. We're not actually cutting off heads, but we're canceling people, and we're basically uprooting things that have stood for, in many cases, centuries, because the radicals who were doing this have this Marxist idea. It's kind of like the French Revolution. At least it sounds exactly like it from what you're saying.
Right. It's a sales technique. So if I was a toothpaste salesman, the first thing I do is tell you negative things about the toothpaste you're currently using. You're still brushing with that old stuff. Haven't you read it'll eat the enamel off your teeth? You're like, ooh, really? You're repulsed by it. Now I have you in a neutral where you're open-minded. What are all the toothpastes out there? Then I give you my pitch for this brand new tartar-controlled breath freshener toothpaste. So that's what they do. They go into the classrooms. They tell the kids all the founding fathers were bad. They were evil, chauvinist, slave owners, and the kids are repulsed by them. Then you get the kids in a neutral, and then you brainwash them into your socialist, LGBT, Sharia, Islamic future. But and France went through this during the French Revolution.
I always want to ask people, why do they today celebrate the French Revolution? It's an amazing thing. They say Bastille Day like it was a good thing. You just said what I know. It was a bloodbath. It was a nightmare. But they still celebrate it, don't they?
Yeah, well, they do. And matter of fact, there was the Vendée, which was a rural area. And the French secular government sent its military up there and killed 300,000 men, women, and children, considered the first modern genocide. And this became a model for every socialist revolution since, where you'd kill off the old order and then you can bring in your new. Well, what happened is, back to the Plato model, that people having democracy, republic, without having morals, it turns into chaos and lawlessness. And out of that, they want someone to come along and fix it. Well, in France's case, it was Napoleon.
Well, but in every case, it sounds like this is because they pushed God out. In other words, in order to murder people, in order to do genocide and feel justified, you can't believe in the laws of God. You can't believe in God. You have to push God out. And that's why in the French Revolution, they pushed God out very explicitly, and they felt no guilt in doing these kinds of things. It was kind of like a new reality without God. And that's what you get over and over with Marxist regimes, as far as I know.
It's true. So when Napoleon conquers Europe, afterwards, the king of Prussia said, we can't get conquered that easy again. We need to strengthen our state. And so he gets a philosopher named Hegel, who teaches at the University of Berlin. And he has a student named Karl Marx. And Hegel said, the state is God walking on earth. The state is our mortal God. All the worth that a human being possesses, he possesses only through the state. The state acknowledges no abstract rules of good and bad. Like, what's an abstract? You mean like the Ten Commandments? It's just a power grab by the state if you get rid of God.
So it's fascinating to me how consistent this stuff is, right? In other words, you're talking about if you believe in truth and virtue, or you believe there's no truth and virtue, you just believe in power. Hegel is making that case. What year roughly was Hegel making this case?
1820. And now another is Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who wrote The Social Contract, right? So we get rid of covenant, and now it's just a social contract. Rousseau said, if the state says to an individual, it is expedient for the state that you should die, that individual ought to die because his life is a gift made conditionally by the state. So once you get rid of God, it's just a power grab by a bunch of people. And if you help them grab power,
and you see, but you see it over and over. This is exactly what the Nazis did. It's exactly what the Soviets did. It's exactly what China is doing right now. This is called godless communism, Marxism, socialism, whatever it is. We're talking to our friend. I got to say, Bill Federer is just a joy every time we have you on here. We're going to be right back. Final segment with Bill Federer. Folks, I'm talking to Bill Federer. AmericanMinute.com is the website. Bill, you are just a treasure trove of information. We just got a few minutes left. What else have we to cover?
So it's a phenomenon that democracies and republics only work if the people have morals and virtue. If they give up the morals and virtue, it turns into lawlessness and chaos. And then they want someone to come along and fix it. Somebody comes along promising to fix it, but they usurp power and end up being a dictator. Some politicians have learned how to speed this along by intentionally removing morals and intentionally creating crisis to make people panic. And I go through that in the book. So Machiavelli lived 500 years ago in Italy. It was a bunch of city-states that fought. And Machiavelli thought if one prince could control all of Italy, it would stop the infighting. So he writes a book called The Prince, where he advocates the ends justifies the means. The end of one prince controlling all of Italy is such a good end that any means necessary to get there is justified. Lie, cheat, steal. So if a prince conquers a city, the people would hate him. But if he pays criminals to kill cows, burn barns, and make people panic, the people will cry out for help. The prince will come in and get rid of the very criminals he bribed to create the mess. No one will know the better for it, and everyone will praise the prince as a hero. So it's good marketing. You create the need and fill it. You go around the back of the house and set it on fire. Then you go around the front of the house and sell them a fire extinguisher. And they'll pay anything for it, even thank you for being there.
So do you see this happening in this country in any way right now?
Oh, yeah, every day. Matter of fact, it's called Machiavellianism, where you create or capitalize on a crisis to consolidate control. Or more recently,
so COVID. In other words, COVID is a real thing, but obviously, people who believe in big government at this point, it's mostly Democrats. They have used this crisis to take tremendous control, and people don't know what's going on, and they kind of tend to go along with it. But we're telling them maybe they shouldn't.
Right. So you have Rahm Emanuel, never let a good crisis go to waste. It's an opportunity to push your agenda. So you and I see a crisis. Our response is, how can we help people through it? They see a crisis. Their response is, how can we usurp power away from the people? Now, Machiavelli, it was in the 1500s. Now we got to Hegel, early 1800s. Hegel takes this and turns it into a triangle. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Sounds complicated, but it's not. So you start off at the first corner of the triangle, the thesis, that's the status quo. You create the antithesis. In other words, you create a problem that's real bad, and then everybody will be happy to settle for your synthesis, which is the top corner, which is half as bad. And then that becomes the new starting point. You create another problem that's real bad, and everybody's happy to settle for your answer that's half as bad. And then you create another problem that's real bad, and everybody's happy. And every time the people are willing to give up a little more of their freedom to have order restored. And 45 countries fell to communism this way.
Well, and that's what's happening in America, because if you do not know, it's why I wanted to have you on the program. If people don't understand how this works, and if people don't understand how freedom works, how self-government works, how virtue is important, how our exercising our freedom is important. If you don't understand that, we all drift in the same direction, because there are always powers at the top looking to exploit the situation. We're at a time. Bill Federer, you can be found at AmericanMinute.com. You've got a lot of important information. You wrote the book Socialism, The Real History from Plato to the Present, available at AmericanMinute.com. Folks, don't forget to go to MyPillow.com and MyStore.com. Please use the code Eric. Bill Federer, always a joy to speak with you. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Eric.
Folks, we have a new sponsor. They're called Nutramedics. That's M-E-D-I-X, Nutramedics. They are a professional supplement brand trusted by doctors since 1993, and they're now available to us. I have begun to take them. Everything you take, they make. So why would you go with anybody else when Nutramedics, are you ready for this? They give more than 50% of all their profits to missions and to charities. Nutramedics.com. If you use the code Eric, whatever it is that you buy, zinc, magnesium, all the stuff, and I'll tell you about it at another time, but Nutramedics.com, use the code Eric.